Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. Okay, I have a confession to make. I didn't know why you guys were confused at the end of our last seminar, but I was responding to some questions about the roadmap, and I had decided to reverse the second and third seminars, and the email giving you a heads up on that did not leave my email. It did not get sent somehow. So my apologies on that. So we're circling back to do seminar two to look at how to change mind, brain, and behavior. So thank you for your understanding of that, and I'm sorry about the confusion. I wanted to respond to a kind of a composite of some questions and see if this is helpful. And this is about specific focus change in performance coaching. I would call it deliberate practice, but this is a good example of how to help our clients look at and focus on change. And it's a story from one of my mentors, Dr. Anders Ericsson, who has done groundbreaking research since the early 90s in performance coaching and performance neuroscience. Angela Duckworth, who you may know, also one of my favorite authors, she wrote, among other things, Grit, a significant book for coaching. She was consulting with Dr. Anders Ericsson in Florida and indicated that she had been jogging an hour a day, several days a week, since she was 18 years old, but had not gotten faster in all of that time. For thousands of hours, she was practicing, but not improving. So she asked the expert. And Dr. Ericsson, who has spent his professional lifetime studying the elements of experts as they become experts and researching the art and science of how someone practices to become expert and what they do to perform exceptionally, he simply asked Angela five questions. Do you have a specific goal for your training? Before you go for a run, do you have a target in terms of the pace you want to keep? Do you have a distance goal for each run? Is there a specific aspect of your running you focus on and improve each time? And lastly, can I get a mute for the background noise, please? This is still open mic because I want to get your responses. And lastly, do you have a coach? She answered each of these five questions with a no. And Dr. Ericsson said, well, I think I understand. You aren't improving because you're not practicing right. And each of these five components, these five questions, are five components of deliberate practice, of specifically how to practice to get better. And these, I'm mentioning this especially because this is something that we can incorporate in our work in mentor coaching. And one other in response to a couple of other questions with another brief story. Basically, how can you get someone to change? Blaise Pascal, French mathematician and philosopher in the 1600s, addressed that question. He said, people are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they have themselves discovered than by those which have come into the minds of others. Let me ask one more time for a mute on the background noise until you're ready to talk. Are there any comments or questions or any check-ins any of you have before we launch into our seminar? Anything you'd like to add to the hopper for what we discuss? Well, thank you for all the things you've sent, the questions and the responses. I welcome those, and I continue to welcome those because I'll work them into our discussion. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise and your your dog can have at it. So I will come back for any discussion, clarification at the end of our time together. So we're going to look at what you have in your outline as seminar two, how to change mind, brain, and behavior. So let's approach this in a very simple way. How, let's even be simple, why do we resist change? Even changing a story that doesn't work. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often doing it harder, and expect a different result, even when it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So let's go about approaching this question about why we resist change, because I think it can help us to work with a client to catalyze change and transformation. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure. It's predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's our default mode. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. That can create the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, doing things in a different way, any change, generates uncertainty and trepidation. And the easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. There is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Another part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags, indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn despite it being very circuitous. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. And when he did this in subsequent days after snow, no matter how many twists and turns, each person followed the path of least resistance. He was astonished that not a single person took a more direct route. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain. By early experiences, and then repeated until they're etched more deeply. What we tend to repeat, our brain hardwires for economy. Even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. So to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the circle and the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight can be a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. This is exactly what we do in coaching. We break the script to get someone to consider opportunity, possibility, new ways of thinking. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, a new context. So we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, where your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed or as intuition of a wrong choice. my gut's telling me this is not the right thing? Or is the signpost of change and progress? It depends on how we frame it. We'll come back to that. Discomfort and uncertainty began any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located really close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. Same for change, same for transitions. And we'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. But remember, each time your client takes a step into a new or different response or behavior or feeling, it may register as this isn't what I'm accustomed to, this is uncomfortable, or some kind of trepidation. That's the brain's printout to recognize that this is different. So we may want to be sure that we empathically resonate with how the client is experiencing doing something new and different, and to listen to be sure that it's not misinterpreted or mislabeled or misread. If that trepidation and uncertainty is read as, my gut's telling me this is not the right thing, my intuition says it's wrong, that's a misread of a very understandable aspect of mind and brain behavior, to have a bit of uncertainty because something is new and different, because the error detection mechanism says this isn't what I expected. So we struggle at times to embrace change. You know, earlier I mentioned that many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and brain work. That's why I think it's so important that as mentor coaches, we have a real appreciation of mind and brain and performance science to incorporate this information to use in working with and facilitating this process with clients. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. I want to discuss in this session what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients: regulating states of mind. Never more important than at times of change and transition. So let's talk just a bit about this. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information, and how we respond. So a state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavioral patterns. A key element in mentor coaching is helping a client at times become aware of various states of mind, and coupled with focusing on what state works best for what purpose. So this is important as a part of self-awareness and self-reflection that we're helping the client develop, and empathy with themselves so that they're more familiar with their story, what facilitates, what interferes with developing their story. Here's a brief illustration of a kind of a black and white example of how states of mind are like different software packages. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go over and over. Now, if before you teach the rat to get to the cheese, you inject it with a little bit of amphetamine, a little bit of speed, so that it slightly alters the state of mind, kind of like a barely registered stress state. You teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It has in a part of its brain how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it. And that rat can, in that maze, literally die of starvation because it can't access how to get to the cheese. State-dependent learning and state-dependent memory. Now, this is kind of an extreme example of two distinct states of mind without overlap. And it's probably most analogous to other kinds of extreme stress like post-traumatic stress disorder, where an entire event may be remembered only under certain situations, or in multiple personality disorder, where different states exist without the seamless blending of moving from one state to another that we usually experience in our lives. A more common example of this is, think about when you've tried to remember someone's name and can't. You know it's on the tip of your tongue, but you just can't recall it. Then later, forgotten about it, in a more relaxed state, boom, the name comes easily. So a state of mind is a psychophysiological state. It's a mind-body state, like a specific software program that then determines how we perceive and process information and respond. Each of us has a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even perhaps how to enter and exit various states. I'll give you an example in just a minute. It's very important to become aware of what state to enter, say, for a creative endeavor. When you sit down, if you've decided to write, to really focus on that and enter the state of mind for that creative flow without interruption. And if you decide to do something different part of your brain, different state of mind, if you decide to edit, then that decision to do that can be important, not to go back and forth because it takes too much cognitive reserve to do that. So that's something about being aware of what you do. Now, here's a couple of, I'll give you some extreme examples. The regulation of feelings and states of mind involves understanding and mastery of a particular state without having to repeat something. You want to, let's say, you want to remember an experience without repeating it. You don't want to dip back into that state and repeat all of the feeling or the aspects of it. But here are how some artists and writers enter a creative state. Just to give you an example, these are going to sound a little goofy, but you'll hear the purity of this ultimately. Just hang in there. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a preamble to enter her genre of the mind to write her macabre literature. She actually wrote from the coffin at times. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite nonfiction writers, Diane Ackerman, write on a pine plank while they're in a warm bath with bubbles that kind of makes them free and floaty. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm, so he could later recreate this experience on canvas when he got back to land. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving theory. And then the corresponding state of mind of the reader often matches that with the author, because the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of the imagery, the rhythm of feeling. So the practical application here is, as we've talked before, and I want to reiterate here, our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. The activation pattern is exactly the same in the brain for both. What that means is how it's labeled. If you label it as anxiety, that boots up a particular framework, a particular state of mind that will process the remainder of the consideration. If it's interpreted or framed as opportunity, as excitement, then that's a very different mindset and you're in a very different process and neurochemical system in your mind and brain to process that and look at it in a different way. This is the juncture that we operate as mentor coaches, the choice architecture of the present moment. At that instant when someone will frame what they're about to say, but perhaps not even be conscious of it. So this is also why, as you know, I will ask permission from each client I work with in mentor coaching if I think that it might be helpful for us to consider something at the instant you say it. May I have your permission to interrupt you for us to consider? And then I give them permission to interrupt me. And, of course, it goes both ways. So someone begins with, well, the problem is I'll interrupt them. Let's look at the possibility. I know they got the problem down. That's Milton Erickson's path in the snow. They got that path well-worn for a long time. What they may not know or even think about doing is to focus on possibility, on what's next, to look at a different mindset. And that is what we can then collaboratively pursue with a client. So the application, one of the applications here, it's important for us to enter into and hold that mind-body state of the client to understand their subjective experience and what they're communicating, because we also want to help them be more attuned to themselves, to be empathically appreciative of their experience. And remember the scientific use of empathy. It's not a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. It's a means to a better end. So this is something that a client will develop, ideally, as the work in mentor coaching proceeds, because this self-awareness and self-reflection is something that they'll internalize and develop as an internal narrative. And some of you have heard me quote a couple of studies before. There are two studies, one from Scientific American Mind and one from the Harvard Business Review, that found that the premier quality of the most successful executives was the above a number of things, including degrees, experience, training, all of that, was their ability to self-reflect and self-regulate. Now, that's only because only executives were studied. I think that's the case with everyone, and I think that's one of the primary things that we help our clients do, that they can continue for a lifetime. So once we're then tuned in to the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. And this works just as well by telephone. Sometimes it can be interfered with visually if you do Zoom, or if you do a video conferencing, but this is a resonance with the energy field of the client, and it's an attunement that the client can then develop themselves. So then together, we explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations beyond where the client has ever been before. And we know from a number of sources, people commit to what they co-create. This is why we want to be sure that the client has verbalized from each session what they commit to, because that puts it in an output channel. It makes it more memorable, more accessible. And when someone commits out loud to doing something, even to themselves, by writing it down, they're more likely to follow through than if it remains without that commitment. So let's look just a moment at how to regulate states of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the crucial strategy of managing and regulating their states of mind using drugs, alcohol, or some addictive substance or process or person to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can be a significant compromise. A state of mind, the particular software program you choose, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. This is where framing comes in. The first aspect of what we may do with a client is to listen to how they're framing the issue. That's their first sentence of what they're considering, and we consider the framework. When someone begins with, well, the problem, they're framing in a problem mindset. So this is especially what I think it can be helpful for us to be attuned to and look at ways of collaboratively creating a different way to focus, to frame, and to proceed then in looking at developing that. Now, since our state of mind determines the meaning we attach and the meaning determines the behavior, when we change our state of mind, we change the behavior. Now, there are a couple of primary ways to regulate a state of mind. One is physiology, one is focus. Now, these both come into play in, I believe, what is a prototype example of the process of what we do in mentor coaching in working with a client, and that's mindfulness meditation. It incorporates both physiology and focus. You get relaxed. You focus only on your breathing, of breathing in relaxation, of breathing out any tension. And there's a way to handle any interruption of that focus. If you have a thought or an image or anything else, let it go and refocus on your breath. This is exactly what you do with a client. You're focused and attuned to that client, what the client is experiencing, and ideally empathically resonating with their entire state and thinking and feeling and what they're saying. So that in the beginning, this is even more of a challenge if you begin to think, yeah, well, this is what I would recommend a client do, or what's a good question to ask here? In sports performance, that would be called a choke, because anything, even for a nanosecond, that disrupts that flow of the focus on the client will be an interruption. So immediately, with any signal of any interruption of that focus and flow on the client, just like with your breath, if you begin to have a thought, let it go, refocus on your breath, refocus on the client. You're helping the client develop their story. And this is in the foreground of what you're doing. And what you're doing with the client is what they're unconsciously downloading while you're talking about other things. This may be the most valuable thing that we do for our clients, instead of, or even more important than problem solving or strategies or success systems. We're helping the client self-regulate and apply that process to whatever they decide, and to do it one step at a time. What's the next step? And often when your client may seem resistant, for example, consider if they actually are resistant, if they're opposing you or themselves or in some kind of internal struggle, or if they simply don't know what the next step is. That's probably more likely. So we want to shrink the change in this system that we're developing with a client and illuminating and illustrating each coaching session when we began by asking, what do you want to focus on? Where do you want to get to? You've created a map. Now, it's up to you and the client together, you leading the way, of facilitating the progress, the successive approximation toward the client's goal. That's a model that they can download. It may be one that they haven't experienced before. I mean, think about it. You sit down at your desk to do something, boom, you're thinking about three or four things. You're likely not to say to yourself, I'm going to pick one and stick with that no matter what other interesting stuff happens. So here's a kind of illustration. Because asking an effective question determines a state of mind. The best mentors, leaders, teachers are ones who ask the best questions. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? Listen to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley at the time to become CEO of Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world? So here's an example, and I'll tell you how I apply this. Write down this to-do. Not right now, because you'll need to give a little bit more time than I'm going to allow you. Write down three questions that will put you in a peak state of mind. Sometime during the day, before you go to bed at night, and then each morning, answer these three empowering questions and feel the answer. Now, what we know is, as we wake up, before we're even consciously thinking about anything, we're already asking ourselves questions. This just changes the focus to constantly and consciously engineer to questions that empower you. Here's an example of the use of that. I have a buddy who does a Vistage group. It's a group of CEOs and business owners. And she asked me if I would come and present to the group and work with them on some stress management stuff. And she told me that two of the members, there were almost 20 people in her group, and they meet all day, one day a month, that two of the members had in very recent time, very troublesome happenings. One was a CEO, one was a business owner. At their companies, one had a fairly massive injury incident. Another had a situation where there were some major safety compromises. One person died. And she was mentioning how even a few months later, both of these people could not get this out of their mind. And she was seeing in her group how it was affecting the group, because there was a carryover, and they each reported how it was still affecting people in their organizations from the top down. And as we met and did this kind of applied workshop, I asked both of them, when they first woke up each morning, what did they think or ask themselves? And both of them talked about still the incident. First thing, always, every morning, what bad can happen today? How am I going to be sure this doesn't happen? What are the repercussions? What's the long-term effect on the people, on the company, on the value? I suggested that they try something. This exercise, explaining that we always ask questions. They're very aware of their questions. Most of us aren't. to write down three questions that would put them in an empowered, positive state of mind, because the first things we think boot up a mindset that engages the first part of a day. I mean, think about you get up, you stub your toe, you've got, you know, a lousy 2 or 3 hours coming because you're in a bad state of mind. And similarly with good example. And I recommended that. And the first thing, as soon as they turned on their bedside lamp before their feet ever touched the floor, to answer those questions that would be empowering, putting them in a positive state of mind. And each time they wrote them at night, they may write the same one. They may upgrade them or change them out or find which ones work better and repeat those. I got a call from my buddy a week later saying, it's amazing. They reported that there was a significant turnaround with them and their executive and management team in a week's time, because they were then approaching things in a very positive way, not a playing not to lose, but a playing to win mindset. So that's how framing can make a difference, how establishing consciously a frame of mind to engage possibility can make a significant difference. If you want to pursue this a little bit more, instead of taking time here, there's a 30 or 35 minute webinar. It's a free webinar that you can access the very bottom link on the homepage of MentorPath, MENTORPATH, my website, is a webinar that is simply called Master States of Mind. And you'll see some examples and illustrations of the application. You'll hear, I'm pretty sure, the initial mentor coaching client work that I did to hatch the idea of the neural conditioning chart and how that can create a neural conditioning and change for the brain. So that's something that I think could be useful to you. Now, an aspect of what that's based on and what we're talking about here is how we link with strong emotion to whatever is happening around us. There are two forces that we all have that are powerful motivating forces for our behavior, even how we perceive things. The need to avoid pain and the desire to gain pleasure. So these are both biological. The need to avoid pain and the seeking of pleasure, both biological forces. So trying to create success by creating more pain usually doesn't work, because we do much better to seek pleasure than simply to avoid pain. But they always work together. So these are things to consider, because, for example, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight. The piece of cheesecake is real, it's tangible, it's specific, there's an immediate pleasure. You know right as you are about to take that first bite, you're going to get a hit of dopamine. And the idea of overweight, that's in the future. That's an abstract notion. Same with saving money. You know, you can have all the ways of calculating the future value of money, but still, getting on the computer and buying something at Amazon, that's right now. So if you're doing something that you're doing that you're not wanting or is not in your best interest, you may be looking at the seeking of pleasure. If you're not doing something that you want or need to do, you may link more pain with doing it than not doing it. So let's look. This is a kind of application of the surface story and the shadow story we talked about before. Let's say your surface story is, I want to generate more income and create wealth. That's the desire to seek pleasure. Now, here's the shadow story. Well, all this effort, I think I'm just as comfortable where I am. Or I'd have to take advantage of, or people will judge me, and I'll be ostracized. I'm going to be lonely at the top. And the idea of future saving and future income, that's great. But this is something that is important in coaching. So in the present moment, in the choice architecture of this moment, this instant, if you're sabotaging success in any area of your life or simply not pursuing it, look at the approach, wanting pleasure, and the avoidance of having fear. So if you have a plan, let's apply a prototype situation here, procrastination. You have a plan, you know exactly what you're going to do, you have everything planned out, you get to the point, the moment that you initiate that action, but then you stop. So as a coach, you may want to ask that client, at the instant you stopped, what was the internal conversation that you had that you decided to stop? So you'll be listening for something, pardon me, such as internal bargaining. Well, I'm going to do it next Tuesday. I decided I need to do some other things first. Or, you know, I think I'd put all that effort and energy into it, and then I'd fail. I'd be really embarrassed. Or any number of other things that are based on avoiding an anticipated pain. So this is something I think to be aware of when somebody sets a goal, has a plan specifically, knows what the first step is, but doesn't do it. So I think it'll be much more productive in collaboration with that client rather than to consider them resistant or sabotaging their success. There's no active plan of sabotaging success. That's too kind of ethereal and abstract. Anyhow, they simply are avoiding an anticipated pain by taking that first step. So that's the choice architecture of that moment, to look at that step. Is your story limiting in any area of your life? And here's something as a kind of a sidebar here. Remember the thing that most often keeps you from getting what you want is the story you tell yourself about why you can't have it. And people get stuck because of the story they tell themselves, one that came from 10 years ago, or the one they want to believe, or the one simply that's the shadow story of an assumption that can be limiting or simply avoiding an anticipated pain. So how you condition yourself to make changes that last, there are three pretty fundamental steps. I'm reducing what we've talked about with the roadmap to just practical coaching considerations here. Identify what to change. Someone needs to get to the point where they feel they must change something, change it now, that they can change it, and that there's a plan. Not an idea, a good notion, but a plan. And to feel that not changing would be more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. So here's some questions for that step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to the current choice now? What will be the pleasure with changing? And secondly, you have to interrupt an existing pattern to make change. You have to break the script. to recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. A pattern has to be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. So here are a couple of questions for this step. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic pattern? And then think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it. So here are just, to make this even simpler, at that juncture of when someone stops themselves because of some anticipated pain, even if they haven't gotten to the point of making that consciously in awareness yet, here are a couple of simple coaching questions that are based on this juncture and these two principles. What's the greater pain if you don't proceed? And what's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? That puts those two motivating factors, avoiding pain and seeking pleasure, into two coaching questions. So this, I think, is important as we're looking at helping someone frame and create a way to proceed. So our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, what to do. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. This is the process, this internal mapping that we engage with a client. Mindset frames an ongoing account of how we interpret, how we process, what we do. Researchers at Norwegian University Science and Technology have recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while we go about things in our daily world. The human brain operates like a Google map. So rather than being one big map, the brain is a whole series of maps to operate that are situation or framework specific. That's also why we have to have a story, because otherwise we're just going from map to map, from situation to situation. That's like being in the wilderness and having line of sight only, rather than a map or a plan. So when a new situation arises, a new map's booted up, but we need to have an awareness of the story. And a great model for that is the simple coaching model of looking at a focus and a destination for a specific issue. So this also gets us to the fixed versus growth mindset. I gave you the example in the beginning of Angela Duckworth getting stuck without actually being aware of it in a fixed mindset, and how a movement to a growth mindset can be systematic. And that system was deliberate practice, the five principles that drove each of those five questions that Erickson asked her. So this is what I think can be helpful as we're proceeding in working with clients to really understand how important a framework is and the initial framework of how somebody considers something. So if they boot up a problem-oriented mindset, then I really believe that exercising my permission to interrupt can be helpful. Here's an example of how this can work in a different setting. One of the areas that I think is really underapplied, is beneficial for coaches, is the whole area of appreciative inquiry developed by Dr. Diana Whitney on the West Coast. I'm familiar with her work. She was a guest in my mastermind group. One of the people in her group, Dr. David Copperwriter, did consults in match groups for organizations, doing one in a usual way of consultation to look at the problem, problem solving, the usual role that really good consultants do, and he was very familiar with it. Then, in as much as matched a group as possible, other organizations where he went in, and his initial question was to look at possibility. What are the possibilities here? What are the options that can move you forward? When that mindset was the beginning rather than the problem mindset, there was a significantly enhanced improvement and satisfaction with the work that was done, and in follow-up, that satisfaction and continued progress was longstanding. So I think this is important. Here's an illustration on at another kind of application of the impact of belief and mindset. You guys may have been maybe familiar with it. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over a 3-year period. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test score equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in a 3-year period. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas, at least measured so far, hearing, memory, even cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy an average of 7.5 years. They lived into the belief that they had, or died into it. So here are some things in a kind of summary overview, and I think this is in your outline, to help clients change behavior and mind and brain. Just some fundamental things. Begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. This is taking the client's story as point of reference. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks, natural talents, behaviors, patterns, that highlights and encourages that practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Like, well, this, you know, my gut's telling me that this is the wrong way to go forward, when it's simply a new and different way to go forward, and the error detection mechanism, this is not what we expected here. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. This is part of an active process of unfocus, because when you focus on something new, you're actively moving beyond a focus on what you may be accustomed to. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. That's internally rewarding in itself. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experience, that things aren't just happening. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brain. So give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively, especially in the beginning. Encourage the client to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, metaphors are all maps in their own right. So here are some principles of mentor coaching successful change. This is just kind of a summary. We focus on solutions rather than on understanding why, on co-creating options and possibilities rather than advice or suggestions. Since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to really stay with that change process. The first requirement is claiming ownership of the story. followed by recognition of how to understand and assess and change. These are things that we're catalyzing for the client. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn. So let's review some important elements about mentor coaching for successful change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying the problem won't solve it. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize, the specific goal to lay new mental maps. Regulate a state of mind and manage emotions that creates a cohesiveness and a directed and focused energy. New insights and adaptations can occur through balanced learning, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. That's too simplistic, but that's an essence of an overview here. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model, for the client to facilitate a new level of effectiveness and mastery. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy flow to the new idea. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change comes from consistency and development of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and the brain. And finally, conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process so that they are aware of how to reflect on and observe and be aware of their story to develop more subjective and more objective awareness of their experience. This helps create and incorporate new experiences as a storyline and ultimately to make it last as part of an evolving identity. We're in discussion mode now, so if you want to manage the background noise, I'm eager to hear any questions, clarifications, or anything that might be helpful for us to discuss.
Natalie.
Hi, Dave.
Do that again.
Natalie here?
Yes. Go ahead.
Just a quick question. I'm curious, how long do we have access to these recordings? Because I definitely want to hear this again and complete and write more notes.
Okay, two things. One is, I think they're going to be accessible, I think, for up to a year.
Wonderful.
The other thing is, you know, after a little bit of time, I'm going to change my mind. So you, no, it should be accessible in the outline and the recordings for up to a year. So thanks.
Thank you.
The other comment or question, would you go ahead, please?
Hi, Dave. This is Alex Pagones. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can. Welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. My question is around the three questions that you mentioned about around putting our brains in peak state every morning. Did you mention the questions and I missed them, or did you suggest that it would be better to watch the webinar to get the questions?
There was a third option. I would suggest that you write your own questions that would uniquely put you in a positive state of mind and an empowering position. You know, one of the questions I recall from one of the two people, their companies, is what's the powerful thing that I can do today that would be of immediate and long-term benefit to my people? So another is, you know, what's the most exciting thing I'm going to do today to really create a more positive and effective environment? Whatever it is for you and for that situation. So this is not a multiple choice or a list question. This is something that crafting the question to put you in a positive and engaged state of mind, I think, is part of that process. So that's why I didn't, you know, mention examples. Now, does that, Alex, answer your question?
It does. It does. Thank you so much.
Okay, absolutely. We're exactly at time, but any other quick question or comment from anyone? Well, don't hesitate to follow up and ask or add anything by email. I'll look at what I get and incorporate that into our discussion. We'll have our last seminar next week, so I look forward to continuing this discussion next week. So take good care of yourselves, and we'll meet back here, same place, same time. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Super. Thank you.